can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth when you're young? Oh, it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind when you're young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here's the best part, you'll have a head start if you are among the very young at heart.
Good evening, and welcome to Older Women Live on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We are by, for, and about older women, and we come to you monthly every second Wednesday. I'm Laura Yaris, your host for today, and we have a jam-packed show for you. First up, we have an interview with Professor Dr. Elaine Leder about her research on Jewish women anarchists from 1920 to 1950. Later, we'll wrap up the show with a conversation I had with my sister collective member and dear colleague Marlène Rateau about the current extremely turbulent situation in Haiti. Before we get into the interview, here's a little background on Elaine Leder. She holds a master's degree in social work from Yeshiva University, a master's in public health from University of California at Berkeley, and a PhD from Cornell. She's a professor emerita of sociology and the dean emerita of the School of Social Sciences at Sonoma State University in California. Previously, she was a professor at Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York. She has over 40 years of distinguished accomplishments and experience in academia and public service. She's received numerous awards and grants and has published 5 books and numerous articles on various subjects. For example, her book My Life with Lifers, Lessons for a Teacher, Humanity Has No Bars, describes her work at San Quentin State Prison and Elmira Correctional Facility. Currently, she does victim-offender dialogues in prisons across the state of California. She was born in Lynn, Massachusetts, to a working-class immigrant family. Her mother's family was from Poland, and her father got out of Lithuania in 1939, just as World War II was beginning. His family was killed in 1941 in their hometown of Kupiskis. Elaine believes that this incident has informed her identity in deep and profound ways. She's always been dedicated to understanding how people can harm others and what motivates them to do vicious things. She's been involved in promoting social justice in various ways all her life, first marching with Martin Luther King Jr. in Boston, engaging in civil rights activities, anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, women's rights movements, mental patients liberation, gay rights, Black Lives Matter, and now hashtag MeToo. She worked her way through college and graduate school and was able to overcome the socialization that would have had her become a homemaker, mother, and wife. She held those roles, and she was also a social worker, a psychotherapist from 1967 to 1992, when she worked in mental hospitals, gerontology, foster care, drug and alcohol counseling, and domestic violence as a therapist. And she's been a college professor from 1977 to today, and a writer since the early 70s, and an activist all her life. I recently became acquainted with her through a presentation she gave over Zoom for the YIVO Institute for Jewish Research. The topic was Jewish Women Anarchists between 1920 and 1950. I found her talk so interesting and exciting, I just had to contact her myself, and she graciously agreed to do the interview you're about to hear. So Professor Leader starts off by explaining how she came to interview these fascinating, colorful, and amazing women.
I was working on my PhD at Cornell in the 1980s when I was writing about Rose Pasoda, who was an anarchist labor organizer, one of the women I'll talk about later. And as a result of doing that book, I interviewed a bunch of older anarchist women. And I was so smitten with them, I just thought they had such fabulous stories, that I went back after I finished the book, and I began in about 1986 to do the interviews, because I'd gotten a grant from my college. And then later I was in an NEH seminar, National Endowment for the Humanities seminar, on women called The History of Women Through Social Movements, and we were supposed to do oral histories, and I just went back and dug up the material I had done and interviewed a few more people. So I kind of finished this in 1996, and I tried to publish it, but nobody was really very interested, and I went on to other matters. And then all of a sudden there's a resurgence of interest in anarchism as an ideology, and these women as examples of living their lives anarchistically. And so I call the work Anarchist Women 1920 to 1950, The Politics of Sexuality, because their behavior was really outside of the norm for people, for women of that generation. So that's how it all began.
We hear about Emma Goldman. She was an anarchist, and there's a lot of information about her, and she had a pretty colorful life and all that. But you named so many other anarchist women who we never heard of. And I mean, I'm really glad that there's some kind of resurgence or whatever, and that we can find out more about this. Are there any plans in the works now to get this work published?
I have been invited to give two papers. One will be a scholarly paper for a book out of University of Illinois on anarchist contemporary and historical perspectives on anarchism. And then there's an anarchist journal out of Oxford, England, that's also interested. So I'm writing up the scholarly one, and then I'll write up the one for popular consumption later. But I'm really having a good time going back through the material, because these women, may I tell you something about them?
Yes, absolutely. That was going to be my next question.
Okay.
Please.
Well, first of all, let me situate them in an era. Remember that I'm writing from 1920 to 1950, and this is after the Red Scare, or during the Red Scare.
Yeah, really.
And so there was a lot of effort on the part of Americans to lay low, keep a low profile, not be too political. And it was also an era in which there were great expectations of what a woman should be. She should be a housewife, she should be a mother. If she wants to work, well, let her be a good housewife and mother first. And that was primarily, of course, for white, middle-class and upper-class women. The women I studied were working-class women. They worked as secretaries, they worked as seamstresses, and they were involved in activities that the mainstream were not involved in. They were, I'll tell you some of the details, but I kind of just want to situate them for you first.
Yeah.
They were all immigrants, and so English was not their first language, Yiddish was. They came to the United States in the teens, all expecting that, of course, the streets were paved with gold, as it was expected, but it wasn't. And many of them went to work in places where the conditions were pretty horrific. And so they were in sweatshops, they were in positions of being second-class citizens. One of them, Rose Pasoda, the one that I did the biography on, actually got herself up to the position of vice president of the ILGWU, But she was the only woman on the board, and she was the only anarchist, and she was not heard. She was just marginalized. And so these women were living in an era, and I certainly remember it from my mother and from me growing up. It was kind of the expectations like you saw on the early shows of Mad Men. You know, very conventional kind of lifestyles. Women were supposed to be seen and not heard. Women were supposed to be good secretaries, but could never get to the position of CEO. And so these women rebelled. And they were need to be situated in their politics as well. They were anarchists. Now, most of us, when we hear the word, think that anarchists are chaos, bomb-throwing revolutionaries who just want a society that is a free-for-all. And that is very far from the truth. Anarchism has a really long, deep, rich philosophical political history. It goes back to Proudhon, Bakunin, Kropotkin, and these theorists, and even further back than that, really argued that there has to be ultimate freedom for all individuals, no matter what gender you happen to be. And most of the time, people argued that it had to come from the workplace. But many others talked about it in terms of individual relationships and the way that the power dynamics are operating in relationships. And so early anarchist thinkers were against marriage, because Emma Goldman wrote extensively on how women are victimized within marriage. They also believed in what was something that was called sexual varietism. And we might now call that non-monogamy or being polyamorous. But remember, this is the 1950s, 40s, and to be polyamorous and non-monogamous is sexual varietism. It's pretty unusual. And there were other, you know, there were free lovers and there were free thinkers during that time, but they were a minority. And so these women that I interviewed have interesting stories, but it's in the context of having come out of oppressive family life in Europe. Most of them were raised Orthodox Jewish, and one of them, Clara, was never allowed to be educated until she came to the United States. Her family was, I think there were 12 children, and none of the girls were educated. All of the boys went to yeshiva and learned a great deal, but not Clara. And that was not uncommon in those days. That was also true for the other women that I interviewed. So we're talking about a period of time that they're coming out of great repression and victimization, and they gravitated to the ideology of anarchism, which is complete freedom and independence from other people. And there really is a sense that they wanted true liberation, and that meant complete equality between the sexes and complete equality in terms of economic independence. And they wanted that for women at a time when women were not completely independent economically, except for working class women. Many of the women that I interviewed were the sole breadwinners of their families, because the men that they were partnered with, not always married, were engaged in political activity. Many of the men went to the Spanish Civil War to fight with Abraham Lincoln Brigade. They were involved in the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, or the Wobblies. So they were out organizing. One of them was a sailor, a seaman, and he was out organizing on the ships. So these folks, these women, were home while these men were organizing, but they were also busy doing their political work. And they really didn't believe in the nuclear family per se. They thought it was a destructive institution, and that they wanted to live an alternative lifestyle. In the 70s, you say something to the effect that we want to build a new society in the vacant lots of the old. And these folks were living that. And they tend to be ostracized, if you will, from the mainstream because they were dressed unconventionally. They had numerous lovers at the same time. They sent their children to utopian schools. They created utopian communities, one called Mohegan, up in upstate New York on Mohegan Lake, where they were living a collectivist communistic, but not the big C communistic, little C communistic lifestyles. They were raising each other's children. They were leaving their kids here while they went out to organize. And so it was a pretty unconventional situation. That's why I really loved them, too. I myself had been raised Orthodox and gravitated the first time I read Emma Goldman. That was it. I was hooked. I became an anarchist, wrote anarchist feminist theory in the 70s. And when I was looking for a dissertation topic, my advisor just said, oh, go take a look at Rose Pisoda, and the doors opened for me to meet these women who were, in fact, role models for me. I felt like I was taking their stories, living my life as I live it at that time, and carrying it to the next generation. And now there is a revitalization of anarchist women who are anarchist feminists. Now, let me say, these women would not have called themselves feminists. That was not part of the lingo, the ideology at the time. They were free lovers and they believed in sexual varietism. But feminism was not, they didn't march with the suffragists. They didn't affiliate with other organizations other than other anarchists because they couldn't adhere to looking to the state for solutions. They really believed that they had to live their lives as they lived them, and the state or the church or the synagogue couldn't give it to them. They had to take it for themselves. So that's kind of a bit of an overview on them. Do you want to hear about any of...
Yeah, let's hear some specific names that we can...
Well, I have to say, I do not use their real names except for two. Primarily because at the time I interviewed them, they wanted to remain anonymous. Now, all of them have died, and I could give you their names, but I am afraid to do so because they wanted anonymity. And so I use a first name and an initial. They, you know, their children are still alive, and some of the things that I talk about are pretty private.
Yeah.
I know
no,
who
I get
slept
it.
At home and why they did it, you know, and what their kids thought. I need to keep their privacy.
Of course.
Even after their death. Anyway, so let me first tell you, I was just writing today about Clara. I met Clara, and I think she'd allow me to use her name. It was Clara Rothberg Larson. When I met her, she was in her 80s. Actually, probably her 90s. Yeah, she was in her 90s. And she had emigrated from Russia, and she was one of 12 children not allowed to become educated. She traveled in steerage to come to the United States, allowed to come. And she was befriended by a sort of a wealthy American woman who sort of took her under her wing on the ship. And when the ship docked in New York, Clara's brother failed to meet the ship. And she was only 13 Ooh. At the time, alone. And this American woman took her in and searched out the brother and eventually found the brother, but it was 3 to 5 days later.
Wow.
So can you imagine? So already you got a sense of this feisty kid coming to the United States. Very soon after coming to the States, at 13, by 15, she was working in the garment industry as a seamstress and became so feisty and well-known for her agitation and articulateness that she got sent to a labor college. Now, labor colleges were places for working-class immigrant women to go. There was one at Brookfield, there was one at Bryn Mawr, there was one in Arkansas, they were all over the country. sponsored by wealthy Americans who wanted to educate immigrant women to organize, speak, and write on their own behalf. Wonderful idea. And many of these women went to these wonderful labor colleges. There's even a book about them. And she went and she learned community organizing. She learned to write in English, so she was pretty smart. And she learned to do public speaking and went back to the ILGWU, where she spent the rest of her life being a labor organizer, activist, and wrote for the anarchist journals. She told me a story in which she was arrested on the front lines of a strike where they were picketing in front of a sweatshop. She got arrested. She shows up at the police station, and there's her picture on the wall as one of the most wanted. And she says in Yiddish, give a keek.
Yeah, take a look at that, yeah.
Take a look to her friend, but she gives another name when she's arrested, and they let her go. And her picture is up on the wall. And she did that a number of times. And they never caught on that she was on that most wanted photo. She was like that. She was just a hoot. The other thing about her, which came much later in her life, it's kind of a capstone story of who she was. By this time, I think she was in her 70s. Yeah, it was the opening of Ellis Island Museum, which was around 1975, I think. But she was in a wheelchair because she was aging, and she was a representative of Russian immigrants. And because every ethnic group that came through Ellis Island had a representative, and she was for Russia. And Dan Quayle was the vice president of the U.S. at the time, a conservative Republican. And she was in a wheelchair, and he patronizingly puts his hand on her shoulder and says, "How wonderful it is to meet you, Clara." And she looks up at him from the chair, raises her fist, and says, "Gayevek. Go away. You're a goddamn Republican. I want nothing to do with you. You have done nothing good for this country. Go away from me." And in her 70s, you know, and she just was fabulous. I was lucky enough. She was the best friend of Rose Pasoda, the woman I wrote the biography about. So she gave me a lot of information on Rose, but I got her story afterwards. She was always working in anarchist circles. She was on the Sacco and Vanzetti Defense Fund, visited Sacco and Vanzetti in prison, was invited to the funeral, which thousands tried to get into, but she was invited, saw the funeral, and was present in the crematorium when they were cremated, which was quite an honor. So poignant and tough, but that's how important she was in anarchist circles. She wrote for Frei Arbeit der Stimmer, which is the Free Voice of Labor, the longest lasting Yiddish newspaper in the country. She wrote for Road to Freedom, which was an anarchist magazine journal. She married a Danish sailor who was a member of the IWW, and he was always shipping out to sea and then coming back and shipping out to sea. She continued doing all of her organizing. She maintained a home. They had no children, and when he finally retired, they sold everything, bought a car, and traveled around the country for a year and a half, visiting anarchist communities throughout the country.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, people do that now in their RVs, but they stayed in anarchist homes, not motels, and, you know, lived frugally. She also told me stories that she spent time going to hear the talks by Emma Goldman, and she was very influenced politically and by the charisma and brilliance of Emma Goldman. But she told me some inside scoops. One was that when Emma would come to a house, she would insist on having the best bed in the house, which was often the marital bed of the hosts. She took it, like, you know, prima donna. The other thing she insisted on was having red roses on her podium whenever she spoke. So Clara didn't like that. She thought she was a little too privileged. So even the idol could be smashed in Clara's mind. She was a terrible cook. Even though she had been brought up Orthodox Jewish, she never learned to do the Jewish cooking. So she tried to cook me several times, cooked me Friday night dinner. And it was kind of funny because it was mostly burned and inedible. which I think also typifies the fact that she was an iconoclast and very independent and really stood by her principles. She was not going to be a housewife. She was going to be a political organizer for the rest of her life. And she supported her friends who were deported. Molly Steimer, who was a Jewish activist, was deported in 1921 under the sedition law because she had carried placards and banners opposing U.S. intervention in the Bolshevik Revolution. And so she was deported on sedition charges, moved to Russia, and then eventually to Germany. And then with World War II breaking out, she went to Mexico. Clara sent her money for the rest of her life. So she
Clara herself earn a living? Did she was she still working as a seamstress?
Organizer. So the union paid her for both. Well, she worked piecework in the shops, being a seamstress, and then she worked for the ILGWU as a community organizer, and that too would be paid. You know, she had housing, the ILG housing on the Lower East Side of Manhattan when I visited her. You know, she lived in a very small apartment. She didn't have a lot of money, but she sure had a colorful life. I mean,
Sounds like it.
Yeah, it was fun to talk to her. I could tell you a little bit about Rose Pasoda, the woman that I wrote the biography about. Rose, too, had come from Russia. She was allowed to be educated. Her father was a little more progressive. And as a young woman, she had learned from the itinerant scholars who came through the shtetls. The Haskalah, which was the Jewish Enlightenment
yeah.
Was taking place. And there were young men who would come with books and educate. And she also went to a private school. Her father was pretty comfortable, where she learned to read and write. So she, as a youth, before she came to the United States, carried anti-Tsarist brochures under her shirt, which is pretty scary. She could have been killed for doing that. But clearly she was drawn to being a radical. She wasn't yet an anarchist, but she was radical in Europe. And then her father wanted to marry her off. He wasn't that enlightened. And so she insisted and begged to come to the United States and came with her grandmother, who accompanied her, and then went to live with a sister who lived in New York City. And I got to interview the sister before she died. And she said to me, Rose believed in anarchism the way an Orthodox Jew believes in God. And because when Rose got to the United States, very early into her being here, she became a seamstress with the ILG, but she started to go to lectures. That's how people learned about these ideas. There were little halls in the cities where people would come and give beautiful lectures, well-presented lectures. I mean, Frederick Douglass did that, Emma Goldman did that, all the literary people of their times came through and gave lectures. And so she went to a bunch of lectures and learned about anarchism, was very drawn to the ideology, and actually took up with a man who was an anarchist, who she fell in love with. He was deported with Emma Goldman because of his political activities. And she kept up a correspondence with him in Russia until he married someone else and her heart was broken. Her real claim to fame was her colorful organizing style. She was brilliant, and eventually the ILG hired her to go all over the country to organize seamstresses. She organized in Los Angeles for a dress company where she had all of the women dress up in the clothing that they had sewn with picket signs that the children carried that said, "My mother can't afford to buy the dress that she made." And colorful. You know, she would have people in Halloween costumes. She was so militant that, in fact, some anti-union thugs gashed her once when she was in a telephone booth with a knife, and she had stitches to prove it. Wow. She was lent by the ILG to the CIO, the Congress of International Organizations, to do organizing in Flint, Michigan. And that's where she took up with a married man, Powers Hapgood, and had a long affair with him. She was a free lover, you know, what they would have called, or at least believed in sexual varietism. I should say something else about one of her lovers. It was actually a husband, Martin, Fred Martin, I think is his name. Anyway, he was a political organizer and an anarchist as well, and was about to be deported. And his ship was sailing out of the New York Harbor. Frank Martin. He jumped ship in the New York Harbor and swam back to port. She never saw him again. He got lost in the United States somewhere. But those are three of the people that I know of that she was involved with.
Wow.
But mostly she was extremely fine organizer. And then because of it, the ILG only allowed one woman to be on the board of the ILG, the executive board. And she was elected. She was the third woman to be in that position. And in that position, she really stood up for women's issues, for rank and file, for conditions that were down at the grassroots. And she was very marginalized, both as a woman and as an anarchist. Now, there was a big fight in the ILGWU when the Bolsheviks took over in Russia, because there were the communists, big C communists, who wanted to take the union over and organize it as the Bolsheviks had done so in Russia. And then there were the other radicals, like Rose, an anarchist, who didn't want that central organizing committee hierarchy. She had heard of the failings of the Bolshevik Revolution already, and she fought against the big C communists, the Reds. Ultimately, it almost brought down the ILG, but fortunately, I gather, her side won, and they drove out the more radical, if you will, or more virulently militant Bolshevik types. She organized, went to Puerto Rico, she went to Canada, I mean, she was all over the place, and formed very strong relationships with the organizers of those communities. And that's probably how that went, because she had the resources of the ILG behind her,
okay,
but she didn't have the knowledge of the local community, the local shops, the local culture. So she partnered up with local people to make it work. And they generally were successful in unionizing these sweatshops. And step by step by step by step, it was very impressive at the time what they were able to accomplish.
And how old was Rose Basoto when she died?
Very young, yeah.
Wow.
She died in 1965. I think she was born in late 1890s.
Wow.
So. She died of cancer. She died single. She did have a niece and a nephew. I was lucky enough that I met the niece and the niece's son, and they were living in Levittown, New York, and I pulled up, and there was an original framed photograph of Emma Goldman that had hung in Rose's house. There was a pen that was carved in ivory by Vanzetti.
Wow.
That she gave to me. And all of these papers. Eventually, I gave the photograph of Emma Goldman to the Emma Goldman papers in Berkeley, because I thought that was more appropriate than in my living room. And I gave the Vanzetti pen to the Boston Public Library, where all of their papers are housed. but I was honored to be able to keep them for about 20 years before I gave them away.
Wow.
So, yeah, she's buried in New Jersey, and one of my correspondents knew that I was interested. I'd never been to that cemetery, so he took a picture, so now I have a picture of her gravesite. And unfortunately, I didn't start this work until 1980s, and so I missed her, or I would have really enjoyed knowing her, interviewing her. I'd really like to summarize something about these women. I would say, you know, that they were really dedicated anarchists, and they identified that way. They came to the movement in their youth, and they stayed active for their entire lives. They lived and tried to live in their personal relationships, the ideology. So it was not just politics. It was the politics of sexuality, how they lived their relationships and their families.
Well, an early precursor of the personal is political.
Exactly, without ever calling it that. Some of them, by the way, I should tell you, I haven't told you their stories, but two of them were a little dismayed at how their children turned out. That, you know, they had, the mothers had been out organizing, they live in communes and collectives, and the young people turned out, one of them said, "I raised a petty bourgeois bureaucrat." And that was the greatest regret of her life. And a few others said, "I don't think my children liked our lifestyle because they became monogamous and traditional." So the children rebelled. But these women didn't form close organizational ties with other women. They were in the anarchist world, not just the women's world, the way some of the other kinds of organizers were at the time, around suffrage and later, women's right to vote, etc. And they didn't adhere to what was expected of them as Jews and as women and as mothers and as homemakers. And they also were very colorful and delightful characters. They were charismatic. One woman, she wouldn't let me interview her, by the way. She said, "No, you're not going to exploit my story. I'm going to tell my story, not you." And I respected that, you know. And eventually I looked recently and there really is, she finally did tell her story. So I'm glad that that happened.
How many women did you interview altogether?
I interviewed 8. However, not all of them were Jewish. So I focused my paper on the Jews. And that would have been only 5 plus Rose is 6. I didn't get to interview Rose. And as you said, they were living the personal is political before it became a catchphrase.
Right.
They're the ones who kept the ideology alive through generations from the late 1800s to the 1970s when feminism picked up the cudgel. And I also have to say, I was truly honored to be able to tell their stories. I wish I'd had more time to find more of them and tell more of their stories, because there are lessons to be learned from them about living in a time of repression, of living one's ideology when it's not sexy, when people are consumers rather than activists. And in this case, they provide a role model for us, you and me and your listeners, and to younger generations as well. And that's one of the reasons I'm thrilled that the young anarchists are interested in these stories too. I heard from a young woman who goes to Oberlin, and she had come to my talk, and she said everyone she talked to in college at Oberlin, a rather liberal, radical university, wanted to hear these stories too. So I feel like I've been a transitional communicator.
So you got to write another book now.
Oh, I've got enough. This is my 6th. No, actually, that was my first. And now
the biography of Rose Pasota, you mean?
That's my first book, yeah.
So to learn about the other women, we'd have to read these papers that you're going to have published.
I don't have enough for a book. You know, I only have 6 stories, basically, if I stick to the Jewish women. And 8 if I just do it more broadly. So that's not a book.
If people are interested, once you publish these papers, where will they be able to find them?
Well, I have a website, www.elaineleader.com.
Okay.
And you can reach me. I can also be reached at leader, L-E-E-D-E-R, at Sonoma, S-O-N-O-M-A.edu. And I'm always happy to send a draft or when it's published to link. The scholarly paper, I think, is going to print in August. And the more public consumption one, as soon as I write it, probably by September, will be up online.
Nitzuch mechwu, die Märten grünen, gefinst mich dort, nicht mein Schatz, wo Lebenswelken bei mir schienen, dort ist mein Ruheplatz. Dorten is mein Ruheplatz. Nid such mich wo die Vögel singen, gefinst mich dorten nicht mein Schatz. Ach, schlaf bin ich, wo Käthen such mich
um,
von Tannen springen,
mich dort nicht mein Schatz.
Wo Tränen rinnen, Zähne kritzen, dort ist mein Ruheplatz. Dort
was Linda Hirschhorn and her group Vocalot singing Mein Ruheplatz in Yiddish. This is a song written by a sweatshop poet, Morris Rosenfeld, back in the 1920s. And the song basically says, don't look for me where the fountains spray or where the birds fly. I will be at my machine and that will be my resting place, my love. Before that, you were listening to an interview with Professor Dr. Elaine Leader. One of her books is actually about Rose Pasota. It's called The Gentle General, Rose Pasota, Anarchist and Labor Organizer. It was published in 1993 by SUNY Press, that's S-U-N-Y, State University of New York Press. And you can get it through that major book distributor whose name shall go unmentioned. And you can probably order it also from bookstores and so on. And in case you've just joined us or have perhaps forgotten, let me remind you that you're listening to Older Women Live on CKUT 90.3. I'm Laura Yaris, your host for this episode. And now you're going to hear a brief conversation that I had with our colleague Marlène Rateau about the situation in Haiti, which is always turbulent, but has become more so and finally made the news headlines recently. Bear in mind that this program was pre-recorded a few days ago because of COVID, so the situation may have changed yet again, but Marlène gives us a little background information, and we should all be thinking about Haiti at this difficult time. Une fois que Duvalier sont partis,
on a eu une période de grâce.
Oui, comme un espoir, une période d'espoir.
Oui, comme un espoir. Et puis ensuite, petit à petit, ça s'est détérioré.
Et puis, j'étais pas au courant de cette. C'était comme une entente, l'entente Petro-Caraïbe.
C'est avec toute la Caraïbe, hein. Il y a des pays qui en ont bien profité.
Ah oui?
Comme la République dominicaine. Ah. Ils ont pris l'argent que le gouvernement gagnait dans cet échange-là pour développer des projets comme c'était prévu par le Venezuela.
Puis il y en a d'autres pays qui n'ont pas fait ça.
Haïti, là, Haïti. Je ne sais pas pour les autres pays, mais je sais que sa voisine, la République dominicaine, a bien fait, mais que Haïti, là, ils se sont partagés ça entre eux.
Alors, l'argent n'a jamais été utilisé.
Des projets qui n'ont jamais été terminés.
Alors, c'est quoi la nature de cette entente-là?
En fait, tu sais qu'il y a l'aide internationale. Les pays de l'Occident aident. Mais tu sais que cette aide-là, elle est vicieuse. Hein? L'aide internationale des pays de l'Occident, là, avant on appelle ça, c'était de l'aide liée. Par exemple, ils vont donner de l'argent, mais en autant que leurs produits, ils te donnent de l'argent, mais avec cet argent-là, ils t'aident, mais ils paient des salaires épouvantables à ceux qui vont, à leurs fonctionnaires. Ils t'obligent à acheter leurs produits. Ils font en sorte que les produits du pays perdent de la valeur parce qu'ils font du dumping, comme le riz. Là. Haïti était un producteur de riz, mais aujourd'hui, on mange du riz américain. Le riz vient des États-Unis et je t'en passe tout ce qui vient des États-Unis qu'on était capable de faire. Ils te donnent des industries de confection, d'assemblage. Où les gens sont mal payés, et les choses comme les gants de baseball, on faisait ça en Haïti, qui sont revendus très cher ailleurs. Alors, le Venezuela, avec Hugo Chavez, bien sûr, on peut lui reprocher bien des choses, mais lui, il dit, on va changer la donne. Et comme il était le plus grand producteur de pétrole de la région, le troisième, je pense, mondial, il a décidé que ce pétrole-là, il allait l'utiliser pour aider les pays pauvres de la région à s'en sortir. Ce qui faisait un contrepoids à l'aide internationale venant de l'Occident. Et ce pétrole-là était vendu à un prix dérisoire. Le gouvernement pouvait le vendre aux entreprises du pays au prix régulier et le bénéfice qu'il en tirait devait servir à faire des projets socio-économiques pour le bien-être de la population. Et c'est ça que la République dominicaine a fait, mais que nous n'avons pas fait en Haïti. Et c'est comme ça, il y a eu 4 présidents qui sont passés, plusieurs gouvernements qui avaient eu plusieurs premiers ministres, et en 2018, la Cour supérieure des comptes d'Haïti a sorti, on ne sait pas pourquoi, parce qu'il y a des membres de la Cour supérieure des comptes qui étaient aussi en train de s'enrichir, mais il y a des membres qui ont sorti un rapport pour dévoiler que cet argent-là n'avait pas été au service du peuple.
Et puis où est-il allé, on ne sait pas.
où est-il allé? Puis là, on a trouvé Jovenel Moïse. Avant qu'il soit président, il avait des accointances avec Michel Martelly. Il en avait profité et d'autres présidents, deux autres présidents antérieurs, plus des ministres, des hauts fonctionnaires, même des membres de la Cour supérieure des comptes, des députés, des sénateurs, tout le monde avait mis la main. Donc, 3,8 milliards qui se sont partagés entre eux. Et là, la population qui meurt de faim, qui n'a pas de service de santé, d'école, tout ça, les gens se sont mis à protester. Et c'est là que ça a commencé. Mais là, Jovenel était au pouvoir. Et puis, on avait découvert que Jovenel, le président actuel, s'était mis dans les poches. Alors là, on le contestait. On voulait qu'il démissionne, mais il n'a jamais démissionné. Et finalement, ce qui s'est passé, c'est que à un moment donné, lui, il s'est... Ben, lui, mais depuis qu'il est arrivé, il s'organisait de façon à ce que personne ne trouble son pouvoir. Et ainsi, en 2020, en janvier 2020, on devait avoir des élections législatives pour renouveler la Chambre basse. Ça n'a pas eu lieu. plus tard dans l'année, on devait avoir des élections législatives pour renouveler une partie du Sénat, parce que le Sénat, il y a deux tiers du Sénat qui étaient venus, les gens étaient venus, leur mandat était venu à échéance, il ne l'a pas fait. Donc voilà monsieur qui gouverne par décret. Il gouverne par décret parce qu'il n'y a plus de cadre législatif, donc il fait ses décrets comme il veut. Et c'est ça qui a provoqué tout ce... Et puis, il y avait les gangs armés qui sillonnaient les rues, tuaient du monde, qui demandaient des rançons. Ce qui arrivait, c'est que des gens qui n'avaient vraiment pas d'argent étaient obligés de chercher. Et puis quand tu n'avais pas d'argent là, pour donner la rançon qui était demandée, on tuait celui qui avait été kidnappé, celle ou celui. Il y a eu des viols comme ça, des massacres. Et puis il y a eu des massacres dans des quartiers bien définis, parce qu'il y avait une bataille de gangs. Ces gangs-là se sentaient supportés par le pouvoir et par la police, s'il vous plaît. Alors, ce qui arrivait, c'est qu'ils luttaient entre eux pour le territoire, n'est-ce pas? Des territoires comme Amarty Sen, qui est un quartier populaire où les gens sont pas mal démunis. Dernièrement, les gens ont dû laisser leur quartier parce que les gangs étaient... C'était trop. Il y avait trop de massacres. Ils luttaient trop entre eux. Mais les villes, c'est dans les villes, mais particulièrement à Port-au-Prince, que tout ça se passait. Alors, qu'est-ce que demande la population depuis toutes ces manifestations-là? Les gens, ce qu'ils demandent, là, c'est pour qu'il y ait un gouvernement de transition. Parce que même les États-Unis parlent, et le Canada aussi, parlent de faire des élections le 26 septembre. Dans l'état actuel des choses, on est à la mi-juillet. Ils veulent faire des élections. Les élections ne sont pas faites. Jovenel Moïse voulait faire un référendum pour changer la Constitution. Ça aussi, ça peut être la cause de sa mort. Parce qu'on lui avait donné ce pouvoir-là, les mafieux de sa catégorie, là, lui avait donné ce pouvoir-là, parce que dans la Constitution, on ne peut avoir qu'un mandat. Alors ça fait un... Je te donne, tu remplis ce mandat-là, soit que moi je revienne, soit que quelqu'un d'autre qu'on choisit revienne. Et là, il voulait changer la Constitution. Il avait ça aussi à son actif. Tu veux changer la Constitution, alors que la Constitution, on n'a pas le droit de la changer comme ça. Quand la Constitution qui a été faite en 1987, une Constitution qui a été faite dans les règles de l'art, elle n'est pas parfaite, mais au moins, elle existe. Tu ne peux pas décider unilatéralement un président qui dirige sans chambre basse, sans chambre haute, là, sans député ni sénateur. Tu ne peux pas décider que tu vas faire un référendum pour changer la Constitution. Et son mandat qui devait prendre fin le 7 janvier 2021, il dit que c'est le 7 janvier 2022. Parce que quand il a été élu, comme il y a eu une discussion, il y avait beaucoup de... En fait, ça c'était pas clair, son élection. Donc, ça a pris du temps avant qu'il arrive en poste. Et se basant sur ce fait-là, il dit que moi, je suis rentré en poste plus tard, donc mon mandat finit en janvier 22. C'est sorti de nulle part, mais comme il n'y a aucune institution qui l'encadre, il peut dire ce qu'il veut, il peut faire ce qu'il veut. C'est pour ça aussi qu'il est mort.
Mais on ne sait pas définitivement qui était derrière ça. On peut juste soupçonner.
Moi, je pense que ce sont les personnes qui lui sont proches.
Des personnes qui lui sont proches, mais on ne sait pas exactement qui encore.
On ne sait pas exactement, peut-être qu'on ne saura jamais. Quand tu examines un crime, il faut toujours voir à qui profite le crime. Le crime ne profite pas à la population, c'est sûr. Ce chaos extrême-là ne profite pas à la population. Alors, à qui profite le crime? À ces gens qui veulent toujours avoir le pouvoir pour maintenir le chaos, pour que les gangs continuent à fonctionner, pour qu'ils puissent faire gouverner de manière dictatoriale, pour qu'ils fassent de la répression, pour qu'il y ait de la corruption. C'est dans ces gens-là qu'il faudrait chercher. Ouais. Mais comme ils sont entre eux, on sait pas si jamais. Alors, il y a un appel que... Parce qu'il y a beaucoup de groupes d'opposition. Je pense, je viens de recevoir un courriel qui me montre qu'il semble que pour les groupes de la société civile, face à ce chaos extrême-là, voudraient bien se mettre ensemble. Mais ça fait longtemps qu'ils demandent la construction d'un pays avec un gouvernement transitoire, qui est juste transitoire, qui est issu de la société civile, qui aura pour mandat de donner à ce pays-là la capacité de tenir des élections crédibles, d'endiguer la corruption et d'assurer des services à la population. C'est ça que, en gros, les gens demandent. Mais est-ce qu'ils vont l'avoir?
Merci, Marlène. Thank you, Marlène, for summarizing the situation in Haiti and what led up to the current crisis. At least as of a few days ago, I remind you that this show has been pre-recorded, so things might have changed yet again. But I'll now try to summarize Marlène's summary in English. After the fall of the Duvalier regime in 1986, Haiti went through a grace period in which things were relatively stable, but the situation gradually deteriorated over the years, due in large part to a Venezuelan initiative called the Petrocaribe Fund, set up in 2005 by then-President Hugo Chavez. Venezuela was a major oil-producing country, and the idea was that Caribbean countries would buy oil at rock-bottom prices, and then these governments would sell it at market value and use the profits for programs benefiting the people in these countries. Some countries, like the Dominican Republic, made good use of this money to help its people. But in Haiti, $3.8 billion were basically divided up between politicians and all kinds of officials and remained unaccounted for, and no projects ever got completed or even started in Haiti. In 2018, the Haitian High Court of Auditors issued a report that this money had gone astray, giving rise to angry protests, which in turn resulted in repressive measures. Additionally, legislative elections were supposed to have taken place in January 2020, but they never did. The lower house of the legislative body was no longer functioning. The Senate had only one-third of its members, since the other two-thirds of the members' mandates had expired and there were no elections to replace them. The very recently assassinated President Jovenel Moïse was therefore governing by decree, as there was no legislative framework. Armed gangs formed roaming the streets, and there was and is a huge amount of violence, killings, kidnappings for ransom, rape, etc., to the point that residents in some poor neighborhoods were forced to leave their homes. President Jovenel Moïse basically overstayed his mandate, which was supposed to have ended early this year, but he claimed his mandate would only end next year, and he wanted to unilaterally change the country's constitution, which stipulates that presidents only serve one mandate. And all of this gave rise to more protests. So these are some factors that probably led to President Moïse's assassination. And it looks like people close to him might have been involved, but of course there's no proof of anything. Countries such as the U.S., Canada, and others want Haiti to hold elections in late September, but the people want to establish a transitional government for a temporary period so that proper, well-organized elections can be held. And it remains to be seen if this will be achieved. And with that, our time has come to an end for this month's episode of Older Women Live, so I'll remind you that you're listening to CKUT 90.3. Once again, thanks to my colleague Marlène Rateau, and very special thanks to Professor Dr. Elaine Leader for that fabulous interview about her really wonderful research. If you would like to check out more of Elaine Leader's work, you can look up her website, elaineleader.com. That's ELAINELEEDER.com. My name is Laura Yaris. I've been your host for this episode. We'll see you all again next month. Take care and be safe. We're going to go out with a little something from Sharon Azrieli singing an aria from Offenbach's La Belle Hélène. It's called Il nous faut de l'amour. Écoute-nous, Vénus, la blonde. Écoute-nous, Vénus.
bunga 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 bunga